You're now listening to The Brian Callen Show with your host, Brian Callen.
Our sponsor, DraftKings.com. I will say that from what I understand, listeners are winning huge cash prizes every week at DraftKings.com. Here's the thing. If you think you know football, put your money where your mouth is. That's how I look at it. I don't play fantasy football. I don't know enough about football. But what I like about this whole thing is you got 1 week fantasy means no season-long commitments. Okay, you play whenever you want. If you got an injured player, it's not a problem. It's like a new season every week, so you're never stuck with the same players. You pick your team in minutes. You could be on your way to winning instant cash, whether you know it or not. Okay, and by the way, you get free entry into the $100,000 fantasy football contest this weekend, where first place takes home, wait for it, $10,000. You want a yacht? You want a plane? Can't buy it with $10,000, but you can buy a whole bunch of food and great wine and a very expensive dog, actually. German Shepherds, fully trained. That's what I would spend my 10 grand on. Anyway, head to DraftKings.com, enter code Callen, my last name, C-A-L-L-E-N, to play for free. DraftKings.com. Bigger events, bigger winnings, bigger millionaires. As in bigger, physically bigger. Just kidding. See how I make fun? How I make funny? Enter Callen for free entry now at DraftKings.com. DraftKings.com. And now, back to the podcast. Hannah Lane is our guest, and we're going to let her tell you what she does, but she works for a custom software company, has her master's in psychology. But what I find fascinating about our guest is that tell us what your interests are, and then we're going to get into why we're talking about this, because I know that when I asked Hunter, Hunter's the genius who finds all these very interesting people like yourself. And, you know, we were talking about how social media and technology can be better used to organize things like protests, organize people around an issue, and create a more effective result, or at least more effective noise. So maybe you could speak to that and talk about what you do and how you help with that and if that's a good thing and all that stuff.
And what your most recent project has been.
You also used the word counterculture, which I liked.
Sure. So I'll try to start with that first question about what I'm interested in. As you introduced me, I have a background in psychology, and in particular, I've done a lot of work around design and designing experiences. And my interests are very, very much around how do you design either tools, technologies, or experiences that result in people taking voluntary action or voluntary behavior. And in many ways, this is often called designing for delight, designing things that encourage or enable people to do things that they want to do, so things that are fun to do. I suppose a lot of that is around decision-making and understanding how people make choices. My experience has bridged from working in healthcare in very non-technical spaces to actually designing software and tools for the same purpose.
Wow.
Yeah.
And so, the company you work for has both a very sort of traditional for-profit arm and then also a very interesting not-for-profit focus, right?
That's true. The company actually is structured in a way where its social impact work is part of the core fabric of what it does, although it is a big chunk of that work is pro bono. So while you know, we do have a huge commercial arm and a commercial sector. It's all for the purpose and function of being able to provide disruptive technology for social impact around the world. We do that both locally in the United States and then in countries all across the global South.
You do that. You've done that now in the Ferguson protests.
That's correct. Shortly after the initial incident of Mike Brown being killed on August 9th, a team of ours went into Ferguson in St. Louis to help build technology to support organizing and organizers who were protesting and who were trying to gather people together to sort of call for accountability around the events that happened. And so we came in and we spent about a week in a really intense sort of, I like to call it a peace room, but a war room, building tools and technologies to support protesters.
You are subversive. I'm sure in some segments of the population you're looked at that way. How do you do that? We saw this work in Kenya, I think, during the election, and there was a lot of violence, and people were able to tweet and Facebook and use other means of social media to tell other groups where the army was, what the army was doing, like raping, and where the safe zones were, right?
That's right. In Ferguson in particular, we were really trying to do two things. One was to help local organizers to gather speed and to communicate information, but also to start a national and an international conversation about what was happening. We felt like, you know, similar to other incidents in the past several years, Twitter was the only and most accurate current, you know, given that the actual incident that happened of Mike Brown being killed was out in open, out in public, and there were hundreds of residents in that neighborhood who could give you photographs, frontline footage, video, audio of what was happening that was not being portrayed on news outlets and other kind of more formal news sources. So
yeah, that, less sanitized, less entertainment. Right?
That's right. That's exactly right.
Do you think that that's going to have an effect on mainstream media?
Well, I definitely think that it challenges what people trust and where they get their information. Hmm. I know that there's been a lot of discontent, and very often we have a team that's still based in Ferguson, and I'm always getting texts throughout the day saying, what you're hearing is false, don't believe the news reports, this is what actually happened, here are actual photographs. So even for myself, who is an avid consumer of many types of media, I still have to look at that now with a grain of salt and think, you know, what's not being shown and what's not being portrayed.
So give us an example of how you organized protests in Ferguson, what your part was, what your company did. How did you use technology to create more effective protests?
So one of the key things that we built was a mapping tool, a mapping functionality that allowed people to people planned events all over the country. They planned vigils and protests at state departments and at government buildings, at police stations. And one of the biggest things was, how do you get other people involved and get them to show up and talk about it? So we built a tool that was in real time that allowed people to call out an event, share the details of that event, and register people to come. And this was a tool that was interactive. You could search for events by your zip code. You could find out more details about who was organizing it and what was happening. And this was essentially open to all. It wasn't filtered by, you know, some source that was deciding what was a real event and what was not.
But let's talk about protests for a second, to interrupt you for a second, because I was watching, there's a guy, I think his last name is Schiff, and he's an economist, and he set up a booth at the Occupy Wall Street thing and said, ask a one percenter. And so he was surrounded by all these Wall Street, all these 99%ers, for lack of a better word, but Wall Street, the Occupy Wall Street people, yeah. And they were asking him 1,000 questions. He did a very effective job, actually, of fielding all kinds of very hostile questions. The thing that I always notice with protests, and I think protests are an important part of the democratic landscape, et cetera, but, you know, one of the very difficult things that still confronts anybody organizing is, it's one thing to get together like the Occupy Wall Street and say, you guys are bad. But what you usually get is just a lot of noise from people who are frustrated, angry, and emotional, but are not necessarily having a debate with themselves, with each other, or with the powers that be about how to change things in an effective way. So it's like, we're mad. Here we are. This can't stand. But you and I both know that stuff is great, but people go home, they move on with their lives, and nothing really changes. So I wonder if you could speak to that and how your company could Are you guys aware of that? Is that something is that an angle you're approaching?
So, no, I think you are 100% right. A couple thoughts. I think in the immediate aftermath and reaction to probably any very disturbing event, you, of course, get very, very huge emotions and emotional reactions that are necessary and are important to capture. I think the trick and the challenge is to keep that momentum and energy going and channel it into constructive ways that lead to true social change. And I think that is where many of these kinds of events fall flat. We have seen countless young Black and brown men and women in this country get killed by police officers, for decades. So this particular event is not particularly new. It has a particular momentum to it. It has, been publicized in a way that feels different in many senses, but in order for it to truly lead to something different, yes, it has to be more than protests.
And because for me, when I hear about the Mike Brown getting killed by a police officer, the first thing I do is I say, okay, so this is another young black man, unarmed, who was killed by a police officer, like this other poor guy in the Walmart who had a BB gun, and et cetera, et cetera.
And the guy at the gas station.
Thousand examples. What then happens is I go, that's a symptom of a much deeper problem that goes way back. That it doesn't even mean the cops are bad people. It means they might have been scared. Mm-hmm. They are dealing with things like pattern recognition and their own experiences and what they've been told. And I guess yes, some prejudice or just. But there are 1,000 reasons to be sympathetic to not only the Black population, especially Black men who are stopped on a routine basis. I don't know what that's like. I'm a white guy, man. I look like a lot of cops.
Right.
But I don't pretend to even know what that's like. But I know it's real. And the reason I know it's real is because people don't just protest and go crazy out of nowhere. They don't. So something's wrong. Something's happening. People aren't feeling heard, especially the Black community. And we can go on and on. But then it speaks to 1,000 issues. 1,000 issues. That where Black America has been left behind for a lot of reasons, the legacy of racism, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And I always find it so frustrating because I don't know where to even, I don't know who to be mad at. It's not
right.
The cop I'm mad at. The cop is an example and a symptom of something. It's a symptom of an institution that goes way back.
And it never gets broadened out into any sort of larger platform. I mean, I think this is the same. We're seeing the same thing as what happened with the Arab Spring.
Yeah.
Right. Twitter and all of those tools were incredibly important in helping create that observability. Oh, it's not just you that's pissed off. These other people are pissed off. And it's not just this one thing that happened in your town that Gaddafi did that was bad. These other things are happening as well.
Yeah.
So it does that. And it's really good at getting the point of people being pissed off at a particular individual. Right. Everybody was pissed off at Gaddafi and everybody's pissed off at this cop and all of this sort of stuff. But where technology either hasn't figured out how to solve this problem, or it may just be a problem of human psychology and actually having to think, is how do you then take that specific incident like you're talking about and turn it into a larger program for change? And I think a large part of what Brian's also saying is we can't, like, that larger program of social change can't just be about the fact that Mike Brown got shot and this one incident, because it is something much more endemic.
Well, if I could just kind of respond to a couple of those things. I think, ironically, so I'm obviously coming, and I was engaged in this particular incident through the lens of a technology company coming in, but because we are fundamentally an organization committed to social justice, we have many, many other ways of looking at this particular issue. And many of the organizations that traditionally have dealt with race and racial justice in this country have we had the civil rights movement, which got us to a really critical point. It took us through decades of inequality to a place where laws were changed and we moved towards equality. But there are things underlying that that have not changed fundamentally. And a lot of what we have chosen to now focus on in the last 6 weeks since this incident happened is all of those other factors that still need to be focused on. And in many ways, technology is, I don't want to call it irrelevant, but it is not the answer in itself. Mm. It can be a tool, but ultimately many of the actions that we have done in Ferguson have transitioned to creating space, physical community space for mm-hmm. organizing and for action, doing trainings in civil disobedience, doing trainings in voter registration, doing trainings in conflict resolution. So many, many other things, and particularly engaging young Black and Brown men and women who are usually never included in, even in progressive nonprofit or NGO organizations.
You're giving them a voice. There's a place for them to not only gather, but you're giving them a powerful voice by unifying
them. That's right.
Them. Yeah. That's great.
I think the challenge, Hunter and I, in preparation for this call, chatted a bit that, you know, there is a role for anger in all of this, and what role does that play? And anger can't be the single sole driving force of change, but it certainly is very, very present in the young audience. And finding a way to channel that rage and anger in a way that they still feel very hard to their core what that injustice looks like and feels like. And being able to leverage that and not try to silence it and make it, you know, push it to the side and say, calm down, stop making a fuss, stop being disruptive. I think that's really critical, is how do you take that and start to build a path and a plan for true fundamental change that's beyond just this moment. And we have tried very, very hard, and I think technology can provide a support to bridge Ferguson with the rest of the country and make it not just about Mike Brown or about Ferguson. Make it about, you know, Florida or Ohio.
Chronic, or just chronic inequality. You know,
that's right.
That's never lost on me. I always do these little experiments, and you got to be careful about being anecdotal, but every time I get on a plane, and it's a lot. I always look at first class, and I never see a Black face in first class, you know, very rarely. And by the way, when they are in first class, you know what the first thing that pops in my head is? Oh, I wonder if they're in the music or sports industry. That's what I do. And by the way, I live in Calabasas now. I just bought a house. It's called Calablackless. And the only Black people that I know in Calabasas are professional athletes.
Or actors, musicians,
but actors don't make any money anymore. But the bottom line is that there is. I go to a really good restaurant. I can count. There might be one Black person. So we are in 2014. We have a long way to go, man. We got a long way to go.
But I think that's
I hate to be on a soapbox. I'm not trying.
I think you're right. Like, we do have a long way to go. But I mean, you know, Hannah and I have had conversations about this previously, and you know, I mean, our friend Marie made the point, and we'll get Marie on the show too. But that, you know, it's not about race; it's about poverty.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that was very much the position that, you know, Martin Luther King had reached by the end of his life as well. He'd moved from, you know, he'd done the civil rights movement, and then he became about poverty because that was the chronic issue, mm-hmm. which was a much less, in many ways, popular issue, right? Because it's much,
sure.
much more uncomfortable. And I think that's the thing, is I think we've got, you know, just as we, you know, for us to truly be effective, we need a platform that goes beyond Ferguson, right? And you've pushed it out now towards race. But I think we need an even larger platform than that.
Because socioeconomic.
I think it can't just be even about socioeconomics. I think we really need to, like, you need, because the problem is that if you're a wealthy white person, right, it's very easy to think, oh, like, that's for Black people, that's for poor people. You don't think that it necessarily affects you. But if you're talking...
Or you do, and you feel powerless to do anything
about
it.
Exactly. Yeah. But you need... I think that's the thing. I think we have to start really operating from the place where, you know, we're trying to figure out a system that really creates the most inclusive system and serves the needs of everyone.
Well, but what Hannah was saying, Hannah, and I thought it was interesting, and I hadn't thought of that, is that you are creating space and creating avenues for young Brown and Black people to produce a more potent voice, a more effective voice.
That's right. And I that's 100% correct. I think, I mean, there's a couple of things. You know, I'll say just from our own experience, when we actually first went to Ferguson, there was a huge influx of people that came, and they did all sorts of, there were all sorts of ways people were supporting. And one of the things that, in retrospect, I realized that we did very differently was that we had many of our team out there with young people getting hit by rubber bullets, you know, being in the tear gas, facing the tanks that were brought into town, not sitting in a room somewhere talking about what we could do somehow in an abstract way. And we were actually there experiencing the same kind of tension and violence, essentially, from law enforcement. And that allowed us to gather a great degree of trust and alignment and understanding of the issue at hand that we were all trying to face together. And so that's just, I guess, to say, in terms of creating a space, that's what's enabled us to find, a population that otherwise is never engaged and doesn't trust a whole lot of people to be included in a conversation and to be able to have their voice heard in both traditional and non-traditional ways.
What were those conversations like? Well, you were there. What surprised you? What inspired you? And what disappointed you? And what when you heard them talking?
So I'll give an example. We quickly became connected with a group of young, primarily men, homeless men, homeless boys in Ferguson who don't have jobs, they don't have homes, they feel completely isolated and left out of general kind of economic or political or social conversations. But we're out there radicalized, protesting from the get-go. And, in the course of many weeks of connecting and communicating, we actually had, after we opened our space, we broke ground on office space. After we had, I think, the first couple of days in that space were, a lot of just figuring out what it was for, who was there. And at one point we had a retrospective. We had this debrief session late in the evening, and we went around the table and talked about why we were here, what this experience meant. And of those young, generally homeless, otherwise homeless protesters who are now part of this community, the reaction was that, wow, I have never been part of something. I have never been listened to. I want to learn. I want to be taught how to organize, how to get people on board. You know, I have a special connection to my own friends and my community. I know what they respond to, but now I want to know how to bring them into this larger conversation. So there was really a desire to be connected and to learn and to grow that is not satisfied.
That's interesting. I love that. That's where people can actually see an avenue in which not only they can be effective, but where they can belong.
Where they can be human.
Yeah. Dignity.
That's right.
Yeah. I think that's a huge part of what I think where your people like you and the software you develop, where you guys can really have an impact. I think we are living in a time where most people do not feel represented by their government. They don't feel as though they even have a voice. I mean, you can hear this from a lot of legal scholars. We're losing our republic. And what they mean specifically is that Washington has become an economy of influence where big corporations are battling it out over their own bottom line. And sensible legislation doesn't happen.
Just to interrupt, it's always very easy to, like, what you find is the Republicans and the Democrats tend to gravitate towards certain kinds of special interests. And I think what we have to remember is that it's not the Republican special interests or the Democrat special interests. It's all the special interests that are the problem, right? This is part of what Manker Olson always talked about, is that, you know, if you're the NRA or you're the teachers union, you know, legislation about gun rights or, you know, schools are going to be much, much more intensely interesting to you than it's going to be interesting to a generalized citizen who has to worry about all of these things.
Until Hannah Lane comes That's along with her right. technology. Hannah? Hannah's standing on top of a mountain right now, dressed like Wonder Woman, just so you guys know. Keep going.
Yes, on video conference here.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. You know, I wanted to sort of pick up on what you just said and maybe think about what Hunter brought up before about this question of poverty and how issues couple or overlap with each other. I think that one of the really interesting things that we have had to struggle with is, you know, in Ferguson in particular, race. I'm sorry, just give me one moment.
No problem. Hannah's going to take care of some people behind her. She's got to fight off the enemy. She uses
Who's
her
the enemy,
wristbands.
Brian?
The enemies of ISIS.
The enemies of ISIS or the
not
enemy
ISIS
is...
as in not ISIS as in the Islamic thing. But if you remember, Wonder Woman prayed to ISIS, the mighty god
oh,
ISIS.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Not the Islamic State of. Okay. No. See, that's where people make the mistake. You see, there are two different ISIS. There's the good ISIS, and that's the god that gives Wonder Woman her powers. And then there are the shitheads.
Okay.
Who lop off your head if you're not, you know, Sunni extremist.
Right.
So, yeah.
Well, see, that's the thing, Brian. Your ability to carry metaphor over, like, multiple, it's amazing.
It comes my brain is so big, dude.
Is it really?
Yeah.
How big?
Well, it's not that
so big
because,
that you have to kill it with boxing?
Well, don't forget, I also was in Alaska hunting deer and came up empty.
Oh, nice.
Took three planes, including a seaplane, landed on a lake 1,300 feet above sea level and froze my ass off and spent a lot of time eating out of a pouch and pooing in the rain. And saw exactly two deer. All right. I was so pissed off, I wanted to just shoot a doe, and I was supposed to only shoot a buck. I was like, I literally was giving the middle finger to the entire landscape.
Amazing.
Because even the deer up there were like, this place sucks. It's too windy and wet. And they all went to lower ground. So that was a good 6 days. Hannah.
Yes. Hi.
Did you defeat all the enemies?
I have no enemies.
Oh, okay, exactly.
Oh, wow.
Of course you don't. Of course you don't. She's too good. She's too pure a soul. So you were saying we were talking about poverty, the many layers. We were talking about essentially how your kind of technology can give people who don't have a voice, and how maybe it can bring them include them in the democratic process.
That's right. That is correct. And there's just so many things that we could talk about. You know, I think technology is useful for in many ways for sharing information. For gathering people together, for highlighting voices that aren't normally heard, for portraying things. I mean, you know, in the weeks following the actual incident of Mike Brown being killed, we used that mapping tool I mentioned that we built to organize protests. And now, 5 weeks later, we are transitioning that tool to be able to map police brutality in the United States. And crowdsource information about that so that information is transparent and it's shared widely. And, you know, I think that part of that is, you know, what is the role of keeping conversations going, keeping information transparent, keeping people part of creating the narrative so that it's not being decided from a single point or from essentially those that are already in power. And yeah, so we are really interested in how technology can be used by lots of different audiences, and we do this beyond Ferguson in many, many, many different spaces.
Mm. So just to, I mean, this is coming from a position of education, I'm always a little bit more interested in ideas, and the question is, you know, we've seen a lot of people over the centuries be really good at organizing revolutions and organizing anger and saying that they're going to build a whole new perfect society that's going to make everything awesome. But all too often, those plans have turned out to not be workable. And so while it's important that we be pushing for revolutions, I think we also really need to put some serious attention on figuring out a revolution for what. Because that's the problem that the Arab Spring now has, is that they threw out the dictators and they didn't necessarily have the clearest plan of what should come next. Mao Zedong got everybody to throw out the nationalists and have a revolution, but then it turned out that his plan was, really, really bad. So the question is, we need to put attention on giving these people a voice and all that sort of stuff, and absolutely, that's good. But there's also some hard thinking that needs to be done after that anger, where we actually figure out and articulate a plan, because that's where Occupy Wall Street failed. You know, the Tea Party has some objectives that are easily understandable, but again, they haven't yet really articulated a cohesive working plan. So how do we solve that problem? How do we solve what a society should look like?
Hunter, you ask such difficult, challenging questions.
I know, man. I mean, just lay it. Hey, fix the world, Hannah, in a paragraph.
Well, you've already started. You might as well finish.
God, he's so ambitious, isn't he?
I personally am on that same page with you 100%. I think that there's a couple of things here. I think there's certainly this, what is this larger plan? I think we've talked a lot about how do you harness energy, and mm-hmm. that's oftentimes in short-term accomplishments and short-term goals, but it always has to be couched and built around some long-term vision. And I think, there's a couple of things. I can say that right now we are part of convening leaders in Ferguson. This weekend coming up, the 10th, 11th, 12th, and 13th, is a big revival of protests in Ferguson. There's been a big call out to organizations across the country to come. And one of the events that we're holding is a meeting to kind of start to answer this question about how do we build into this a larger objective that's beyond just getting justice in this particular case. And I think
do you find that is a sentiment that is already present in the people you speak to, or are they so consumed and angry locally?
I would say it's neither and both. Honestly,
good
I
answer.
Think that
that's a good answer. Yeah.
I mean, I was witness while I was there to many county council meetings and other. Other kinds of activities where people were engaging elected officials and politicians in ways that those elected officials are not used to engaging. In particular, if you can imagine being in a county council meeting that is normally relatively boring and dry, talking about, the trash collection or plowing one street in the wintertime. And in this case, it was a completely packed room full of citizens who were demanding answers and asking for accountability of elected officials on the county council level. So in that sense, there is definitely frustration and anger, but it's being driven towards very specific goals and asks. But to Hunter's point, many of those asks are in the short term. They're things about bringing justice for this particular situation, and asking for answers to really, really, really hard questions about, what is the role of the police? What is the role of the county prosecutor who is trying the case, or rather not trying the case? But I guess, so stepping back from the facts of this case, thinking about the long-term vision, the long-term goal, there's certainly objectives to figure out how to prevent this from happening again. But beyond that, how do we get to the core of things like classism?
But do you know how I think you do it, personally? I really believe this. I think, for example, I had this debate. I was doing Joe Rogan's podcast yesterday. And we were talking about the Muslim world, and there was this video on Muslims, and this imam was talking about how all good Muslims believe that, you know, if you commit adultery, you should be stoned, et cetera, et cetera. And it was a very, and what I said was, I said, well, that's a very unfair kind of characterization of all Muslims. And I said, in fact, in reality, I am sure that Americans would be incredibly shocked to realize that they have a hell of a lot in common with most of the Arab street, most of the African street, most of the Asian street. And my hope and my optimistic outlook is that social media and people like yourself are, I think it's going to become easier and easier, and it already is, for me over here, removed by a continent or removed by, you know, 10,000 miles and a whole bunch of different cultural differences. Me over here, it's going to be easier for me to identify and to empathize and to find common ground with people over there, even though they don't have my technology, they look different, they have very different customs. At the end of the day, I have a feeling that those black people in Ferguson and myself share a lot of the same values. We believe in fair play. We want some say in who governs us. We want a better life for our kids. We don't want to always eat healthy. We'd like to fuck up once in a while. And at the end of the day, all of us, or at least most of us, mean everyone, everywhere, all the best. You know, and that's my hope. And that's where I find people like you and your work to be so encouraging, whether or not you know you're doing that. But I just think that's where we're going to start to see change.
Thank you. I just to honor that and to say that one of the most incredible things for me was to see the outpouring of support from around the world about this incident. And we received personal emails from Palestine and from Germany and from countries all over the world saying, you know, Ferguson is just like us. And, you know, justice for Mike Brown. So we know that was felt and heard around the world, and people in Ferguson felt that same thing. They often equated Ferguson to Palestine, even people in Ferguson. So I think there was a lot of identity going on.
Mike Brown becomes more of a symbol in his death, doesn't he, than almost
just like John Brown did before the Civil War.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. Yes. Yes, John Brown, the great abolitionist.
Yes.
God, we have such a command of history
Brian.
On this
podcast. Did you major in history?
Why don't we call this podcast The Mother of All Things?
but to piggyback off of what you're saying, Brian, and I think this is where technology does really become important because, you know, Vanessa C. Tyson, who we've had on the show a bunch of times, has referred to the news as tragedy porn. And what it does is it focuses on, you know, you get a few guys get beheaded and we're reporting all of that. And so now we get this picture that all Muslims are assholes. Or, for example, in the Middle East, you know, when one guy flushes a Quran down the toilet in Florida, it's all over the news for days. And so they think that all Americans feel that way about their traditions. And one of the points that Marie, who's our friend, made was that, you know, although 100,000 people have participated in the Syrian civil war, 20 million have not yet picked up arms. Mm. And that's the thing is, I mean, yeah, that's really what to yes and what you're saying is
it's empowering that the neutral middle,
the
or
silent
at least
majority,
the moderate middle.
That's right. As Richard Nixon said, the silent majority, and, you know, really making them visible. Whereas, you know, the news media has an incentive to report on, as Justin Guest said, right, the guy with the hook and the eye patch, rather than the majority of people who are like, I would like to have a house and kids and a family and, you know, have something to eat.
Yeah. Got anything to add to that, Hannah Lane? She's just sitting there like, God, these guys have huge brains.
Or she's on that mountaintop.
Or fighting. She's bored out of her mind. Or she's like, I got to go do some real work. This is all talk.
Yeah.
I got to get to work. And that is what you do, Hannah. And we appreciate you getting out there and rubbing elbows. Because, frankly, I'm too aristocratic for that kind of
thing.
It's
true, Brian.
They don't have good enough wine or coffee in Ferguson. No.
Come to our come to our offices. We'll make you drip coffee.
tell us how people can get in touch with you and how they can get more involved in what you do and what your organization does. What's the name of your company, etc.?
Well, I think probably the best thing in this particular case would be to go to the handsupunited.org website.
Handsupunited.org. Okay.
That's correct. We've actually worked with many of the local people in Ferguson to build that movement, and that's the best place to go to get involved in what we're doing, to show up this weekend. We're still encouraging people to come and lend their own voice and in solidarity. They can also, if they want to donate books, we are building a library within the space to teach about history and to teach about the future. So, yeah, I would welcome anyone who wants to participate to join Hands Up United.
Great. And, you know, I just want to say that we talked a lot about law enforcement and all that stuff, but I know a lot of people in law enforcement, and a lot of them do a damn good job. And I'm sure a lot of the Ferguson Police Department, even though they got a lot of paramilitary weaponry, I'm sure they do their best. The vast majority of those guys are doing the best they can to make the world a safer and better place. That's just my point of view.
And I think
it's important to keep that in perspective as well. But if obviously, I can't imagine what what Mike Brown's family's going through, his mother and father and stuff, just having kids. So I just want to throw that in there.
Sure. I know what Hunter's going to say, I think. I mean, I won't put words in your mouth, Hunter, but I think, you know, being able to tap into that human emotion in each individual person, I think, is really critical. We can tend to, as you said, generalize about an identity or a population because of things that we see, even if they're repeatedly things that we see. But on an individual level, I think if you can connect with people's emotion and people's deep-seated motivation, I think that you can find that commonality among everybody much more easily.
Absolutely.
Well, and that's the thing. Again, we focus on the cops who shoot young black men while walking around and don't focus on the vast majority of cops who have never done that, right? And,
or who save lives.
Or who save lives or whatever. Yeah. And, you know, what you said was better than what I was going to say, Hannah. But the other part that I was going to say is, you know, there's also, I mean, it's great that you're organizing these people, but also what about bringing cops to that conversation? Because if there's anything that we've learned from history, but most recently from the Affordable Care Act, is that if you try and do something unilaterally, inevitably the side that has it, that feels like it's forced on them, even if it may have originally been their idea, they're going to resist it. And so I think that's the thing, is it's great to come up with a plan. And right now there's a certain amount of political power that's available to, you know, essentially, you know, force compliance on the part of cops. But I think that cops really need to be involved in what that conversation is and what those measures are, so that they feel ownership over whatever new strategies we end up implement to
mitigate. Because they've also, I'm sure, have got a lot to say about the debate, and based on experience and expertise, that things that most of us who are not in law enforcement don't know about.
So. Exactly.
Right, Hannah?
Oh, that's definitely true. You know, I think that engaging all people as part of the solution means that you get a more robust and successful, likely to succeed solution for everybody.
Agreed.
Well, that's what you're there for, and we appreciate all the work you do. And it's handsupunited.org if you guys want to get involved.
And we'll include that link in the write-up for the episode.
You are making the world a better, more egalitarian place. Spoken from a true capitalist, but I'm just saying, I appreciate you and seriously, and I think it's great. So,
thank you so much for highlighting the story. It's a pleasure to talk about and to share and to get more people involved in the solution. So,
awesome.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you for coming on the show.
Yeah. Thanks, Hannah. And for all you guys out there, I'll be in Atlanta at the Anna. Improv on October 16th, 17th, 18th. So come one, come all. I love Atlanta. As Lawrence Fishburne said, it's a chocolate city. Oh yeah, oh yeah. And that's a place where you see a lot of black professionals. You know, it's kind of, and when I did the movie Ride Along, everybody around me was black. I was the only white guy basically on the set for the most part. It was such an interesting example. Well run. And as Kevin Hart and they were like, this ain't a black movie. This is a movie made by three men. And yes, but Atlanta is a good time, man. I'm looking forward to having a lot of color in my audience, my favorite kind. As soon as I see a lot of just white people, white professionals, I'm like, ah, boring. I want Latin. I want brown and black and white and Asian and everything else.
And why is that?
Because I'm the composite man. Because I'm the second coming.
Are you really?
Oh yeah, dude. I don't have any prejudice. I love everybody.
But if you're the second coming, then are you refuting the basic tenets of Mormonism?
Oh no, absolutely not. The bottom line is, come to my show in Atlanta, and I will offend all of you, no matter what your color or race. Peace. And Hannah Lane, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Later.
You've been listening to The Brian Callen Show with Brian Callen. Be sure to like him on Facebook. Just search for Brian Callen Comedy. And follow him on Twitter. Just search for @BrianCallen. You can also find him online by visiting his website. Just go to briancallen.com. Until next time, bye-bye.